company.
Well, I was delighted to listen to part of that discussion. I think you're doing a great job to look closely at something with minimal risk, but to really put all the cards on the table. Well, this is a continuation of our previous discussions on vulnerable subjects. Remember, it was interrupted last month because we did this thing on conflict of interest for IRB members. But in two sessions ago, we looked at captive subjects like prisoners and soldiers, at subjects with incurable illness, at students and poorly insured subjects. Today we're going to look at cross-cultural research and research in emergency medicine, understanding that there are other vulnerable subjects that we haven't looked at. Some protocols exclude women, especially pregnant women or with potential for pregnancy, subjects with mental illness, cognitively impaired subjects, and so on. We're not going to specifically address those. But I thought it was interesting. I saw a piece in the LA Times about 3 weeks ago with the headline, U.S. Apologizes for Syphilis Experiment in Guatemala. I don't know if you saw that. Well, I mean, this was back in the 40s, granted, before IRBs, granted, all those things. But this study managed to inflict research on five different classes of vulnerable subjects. It was cross-cultural research done on prisoners, mentally ill subjects, soldiers, and women. So they were able to do that all in one study. I thought that was really quite impressive. So we want to look at cross-cultural research. The issues here are tension between human rights, which I'm going to go out on a limb and say are universal human rights, versus cultural beliefs and economic disparity. Western culture and ethics is very individual focused. North America and perhaps Australia are the most autonomy oriented cultures in the world, whereas other societies look more at communitarian standards and family issues and so on. But we're very focused on the rights of the individual. And cultural beliefs are very important. I mean, we're increasingly looking at diversity and can be very supportive of many, many cultural differences, but not all. For instance, the international condemnation of apartheid back a generation ago, issues of genocide. And currently, in the literature, in the pediatrics literature, there's a very interesting discussion going on about what's variously called female circumcision or female genital mutilation, and clearly condemned. But there's some discussion in American pediatrics, well, maybe if there's some symbolic significance to it, that maybe just a nick of the clitoris to draw a drop of blood, maybe that's acceptable. And so we really have to look at all aspects of cross-cultural issues. And just because in our culture versus a culture in a third world country where there's major economic differences, we should not exploit those. So part of the issue is consent. On the one hand, disadvantaged subjects may consent to anything in order to get any semblance of what they might call medical care. I mean, if the alternative is zero, they have no care, they may consent to research that really is not in their best interest just because they think they're getting something out of it. And in many cultures, community consent or family consent takes priority over individual consent. Now, should we accept that? Well, maybe, but because that's the way things are done in that culture, but we also have to be concerned about the risks to the individual. Because if the community elders say, we're going to participate in this study, then what do you do about the subject who really doesn't want to? Will we allow them to be subject to their elders? Economic issues, doing research in a developing country because it's less expensive, but then using the good outcomes in our own culture without allowing any benefit to them, even though they have taken on the risk for us. Is that fair? Some conclude, George Annis in particular, in the article that I cited, valid consent cannot be obtained from impoverished populations in the absence of a realistic plan to deliver the intervention to that to the population. One example back, that was over 10 years ago now, when AZT was being investigated for treatment of AIDS. The question came up, should we compare this to placebo or to standard treatment? Well, there was no standard treatment at that time in developing countries. AZT was known to decrease perinatal transmission of HIV, but AZT, well, it still is, but even then was particularly expensive. So placebo-controlled trials in other countries using different dosing or different drugs were done to see if we could get away with using lesser medication here in our culture. Is that okay? Well, let's look at the pro side. In developing countries, there's no treatment. No treatment is the standard. Therefore, it's important to see if the new regimen works better than nothing. And you can do this with a smaller N and a smaller study, less expensive research, get quicker results. So from a utilitarian standpoint, it makes sense. But from a con perspective, using the comparison would be unethical in Western research. We wouldn't dare do that here, violating the principle of justice. And the end does not justify the means, looking at the Tuskegee study and so on. And just a study that was proposed to this IRB back when I sat on it many years ago, looking at a cogener of cimetidine. I think cimetidine at that time was the only H2 blocker for peptic disease. But they had this Me Too drug, and it was proposed that X number of subjects with known documented peptic ulcers, documented endoscopically, would be put on placebo or active agent to compare them, recognizing that standard treatment is to give them cimetidine. And without standard treatment, they're at risk for, what, obstruction, perforation, hemorrhage. And we said, no, you can't do that. And they said, well, we really need to know if it is better than nothing. I said, not the way to do it. Now, the Council for International Organization of Medical Sciences states, researchers working in developing countries have an ethical obligation to provide treatment that is the standard of care in the sponsoring country. Not to do represents an unacceptable double standard. And they go on to say the sponsoring agencies should agree in advance that any product developed as a result will be made reasonably available to the host country or community. Those two terms are not clearly defined, but I think the sentiment is very clear that we cannot take advantage and exploit impoverished people. So, conclusion is that subjects' rights are universal and should be protected in all environments. Now, that's a simple conclusion, maybe even simplistic, though there may be some minor modification based on cultural differences. That's a complex answer, which unfortunately is left in your laps on many occasions. So any questions or comments on cross-cultural research? Seeing none, let's go on to... Oh, one.
What would be the difference between exploiting a poor population for research and exploiting them for economic benefit? For example, slave wages for making tennis shoes.
Right. The question involves the difference between exploiting impoverished people for research versus exploiting them for commerce. And I think there is little difference, but you, I, and the research community has no control over the commercial aspects, but from a human rights standpoint, I think it's just as bad. Now you could make an argument, well, you give them slave wages is better than no wages, and that's a really different issue of social justice that I'm really not qualified to answer, but I think you're on the right track, that there are significant parallels there. Yeah.
In the impoverished argument, I'm curious. There are people in this country who don't have health care and have been documented to commit crimes to get into prison so they can get the health care that we offer our prisoners. In an impoverished nation, not having any health care versus having some health care. You mentioned that was the problem, but I'm not sure that I understand that the problem is exploitation so much as coercion.
I think you may be right that convincing a community to accept research so that they'll get some quasi health care is more coercive than it is exploitative. So I think you may be right. Yeah.
There's been some issues even in this country dealing with like tribes, Indian tribes, mm-hmm. where you have to get you're up against getting tribal consent versus individual, where the individuals might want to participate, but the tribe would not like to hear a negative outcome or an outcome that mm-hmm. that's not favorable to their view of their culture themselves.
Right.
And it just makes it complex.
It does.
There's no right or wrong, but it makes it complex.
There was a study done a few years ago, and I forget the name of the tribe of Native Americans that lived down in the Grand Canyon. It starts with H, long name. Was it just Havasupai? Havasupai, that's it. Looking at their genes, their genetics, in relation to diabetes and alcohol, I think, and so on.
It started out as a diabetes study.
Yeah. Right, and then the question is, who owns the data once it's gotten and so on. So, yeah, that's why I said that my conclusion sounds a little facile, and it's probably simplistic because there are so many factors that come into this. Well, let's move on to emergency research. And this is research that enrolls people with acute, serious, or even life-threatening conditions without consent from the individual or proxy, because the intervention must be started before informed consent can be obtained. For example, how are we going to figure out if new resuscitation protocols or if thrombolytics really work or not unless we try them in the given situation? And the given situation is always, many situations are urgent and you have to start right away, but you don't have time or are unable to get consent. So this is a pretty fairly unique research environment, because absent consent, we can't just let researchers do anything they want, but absent consent, what other protections can we put in place to try to protect the interests of subjects? And how long is the window of opportunity for this consent? Now, this has been looked at a federal level, because, I mean, for decades, there was just this question of, well, we just can't do it. And finally, in 1996, the federal government came up with a waiver process that involves several things. In order to qualify for the federal waiver, the research has to be necessary. There must be no other population in which you can get the data that you need. And there must be some bench research or some animal evidence that supports the need for the research and the possibility of the search, that the outcome may be efficacious. And it's really not feasible to get adequate consent, either from the subject or a proxy. And importantly, the research has to be potentially beneficial to the subject. This is only good if the subject can potentially benefit from it, because we're not talking about minimal risk here. And you have to compare the projected risks and benefits to those of current therapy, and that's not easy to do. But you've got to be able to satisfy the FDA that you've made this effort. And the community of potential subjects must be engaged both at the beginning, in designing the protocol and so on, and at the end, in the follow-up. Another important criterion: if one IRB fails to approve a multi-center study, then the other IRBs have already approved it must be notified of the reasons. And this is going to become important, because I'm going to give you an example in a moment. And DSMB must be in place, and due diligence to obtain subject or proxy consent as soon as that's feasible. And the subject or proxy wish to be disenrolled must be honored. And the PI must communicate with the FDA to discuss design to see if it could be done without the waiver. So there's quite a few extra hoops to jump through in order to do this type of research. And I know I've mentioned the polyheme study to you before, but I'd like to raise it again as an example. You may recall that polyheme is a non-cellular hemoglobin product made by Northfield Labs, to use as a blood substitute to see if it, the trials to see if it had the adequate oxygen carrying capacity, because it doesn't have to be type and crossed and so on. So where I was at the University of Vermont, the IRB was asked to approve participation in the study, being told that there were already 15 centers who were enrolled and enrolling subjects. And the IRB gave tentative approval, but then part of the requirement is that there has to be public discussion and information and education. And so I was asked to help the researchers promote this to the public. And so I said, well, let me review the protocol. And after I looked at the protocol, I said, this is not ethical research. We can't do this. Because this was for traumatic hypovolemic blood loss, traumatic shock. And they put on the mass trousers, and they gave up to 6 units of this polyheme, transported the patient to the ER, and then continued the protocol for another 12 hours, during which blood was available. And I said, you're not using the standard treatment, and you really just can't do that. And so when I declined to be involved in the community education to support this, I mean, part of it was, we're going to tell the entire community what we're doing, and people can get a bracelet to opt out. So if they crash into a tree, they will not be included in the protocol. That by itself is problematic, because most of the trauma in Burlington, Vermont, is on the freeway, and people coming from going from Connecticut to Montreal. I mean, they won't know what's going on in good old Burlington, Vermont. So that seemed a little unrealistic. And to be honest, I thought the protocol looked very good. I mean, they had good bench studies to suggest, and animal studies to suggest this work. And I would volunteer for this proposal if I were in that situation and they couldn't get blood fast enough and so on. But I thought that the rules that we had to follow just did not allow this to happen. I suggested first that they apply to Northfield Labs and see if they could get rid of this 12-hour extension, and Northfield wouldn't budge on that. So I said, I really don't think we should participate in this. And then the final and most, a lot of it was troubling, but one of the most troubling aspects was that when our investigators told Northfield Labs that they would not participate, Northfield said, well, would you please withdraw your application instead of having an IRB turned down? Why? Because if the IRB turned it down, then they would have to notify all the other IRBs of our reasoning and so on. And the PI wasn't aware of that and so said, all right, we'll withdraw it. So it took a while before that hit the press. Now, interestingly, subsequent to that, a phase 3 trial, 714 subjects, no significant difference in survival between the research subjects and the controls. But the polyheme group had a 3% incidence of acute MI versus 1% in the conventional arm. So two things missing from your handout. One, the last letter of the last word, it should be arm instead of R. And somehow the a reference was left off. And there's a very interesting article, if anybody wants to pursue this, in the Archives of Internal Medicine earlier this year. First author is Largent, L-A-R-G-E-N-T. The title is Emergency Research Without Initial Consent Justified? And so that's volume 170, starting on page 668. And I brought along one copy if you see fit and want to distribute that to them. So that's a quick and dirty review of emergency research. Questions, comments?
Well, you made reference, but just to be really clear, we can waive consent altogether or elements of consent in minimal risk. Like we were talking this morning, we could have, without going through this process. This is for a risk that is more than minimal. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think that's true. You can, the IRB can waive consent minimal risk. But this is for significant risk,
right.
Only if there is a potential benefit to the subjects, and you really have to get FDA waiver.
Well, if there's an FDA product. If it's under an FDA jurisdiction. Otherwise, I think we'd be talking to HRP.
Oh, okay. But you need to get approval above and beyond the local IRB. Right, yeah. In a trial, or in an individual,
one single.
I mean,
no, you can do that
physicians, physicians do that all the time. I mean, I think sometimes to their own, putting themselves at risk. But I don't think there's any that we have any oversight there, and the physician takes on the risk.
Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you. We'll move on to conflicts of interest next time.
Number three.